Hey, it's Pat Awencia, and I'm the founder and co-developer of the Baseworks Method. So the Baseworks Method is an approach that focuses on the cognitive and perceptual aspects of physical movement. The Baseworks Transmission Conversations explore both concrete and abstract realizations that emerge out of the commitment to any kind of practice or pursuit to achieve life goals. And our aim with these productions is to find a common vocabulary to help better describe these experiences. So our guest on today's transmission is Joseph Fruchek. It took quite some time to be able to coordinate this talk, and we ended up filming this last year in the summer. So Joseph has a pretty interesting background. It started as an athlete, and then that transformed into a physical theater artist, a producer, director, and installation artist. Joseph graduated from the Academy of Music and Theater in Bratislava, Slovakia, and completed his PhD thesis in 2002. And shortly thereafter, he was cast as a performing member of Ultimaveth, a renowned production by choreographer and director Wim Vandekebos. So he's since then collaborated with theaters, universities, and dance institutes, among other notable stuff, both in production and as an educator. In 2006, he co-founded Rootless Root with his amazing partner, Linda Capitania. That was a platform for their own productions and research. And as a byproduct of that, together with Linda, developed the Fighting Monkey practice, which inevitably weaves in their collective experience into a dynamic mix of educational formats. And this was initially intended for dancers, actors, and movement practitioners, but now has become a kind of movement education that really addresses various different types of learning trajectories. So I originally was turned on to Fighting Monkey after watching a really amazingly produced video, which was kind of a cornerstone video for Fighting Monkey, which outlined really not only how they were educating people, but also the concept and philosophy behind the practice itself. And whenever something grabs my attention this much, I most often than not try to reach out to the people behind it, which led me to contacting Joseph. In late 2015, I had my first conversation with Joseph on Skype, and it was quite a long conversation. We talked about various different things. That kind of led to Joseph inviting Asha and I to come to attend a small group seminar in Athens at the end of 2016. Which blew our minds. And that led us to invite Joseph to Japan. Joseph stayed with us for a week at that time, and we organized an event for him to teach a group of movers and shakers in the education / movement community in Tokyo. And he also did a small group session with our core teachers. Over that week, we had a lot of very interesting conversations about education and perception and art. And that inevitably led to where we are today in this episode. In this transmission conversation, we get into Joseph's upbringing in Slovakia, the ideas behind the FM practice, and the importance of family as a reflective reality of life, work, and personal development. References to everything we talk about over this episode can be found in the show notes. And on a last note before we get started, for most of these transmissions, we'll have a companion episode or content that we refer to as reflections that'll go deeper into the topics discussed. You can find out where to access that in the show notes. So, Joseph, how are you doing?
Thank you, Patrick. I'm doing super well. Thank you for an invitation.
Yeah, well, it took us some time to coordinate it, but I'm glad we finally got it together and we're sitting here doing this. There's obviously a million different ways that I could start this conversation. I think one of the things that I'd really like to focus on in the very beginning is a little bit of history on who Joseph Fruchek is. Now, depending on who's watching, what their background is, they're going to obviously know you from different perspectives, but I want to take it way back. You're from Slovakia.
Yeah.
Who was the young Joseph?
So I grew up in Slovakia, having wonderful parents and wonderful grandparents, being surrounded by beautiful nature, by amazing native culture, great singing, very athletic folk dance. By great nature, I mean a lot of mountains, a lot of lakes, and opportunity to discover them, because my father was taking care of the woods when he was younger, and his love for nature remained. And so he has and had always a great knowledge about animals and plants and foraging and hunting. So great part of my childhood was spent in nature. I could also say that this is so funny. I realize only having my own kids that we've spent after school, we spent all the afternoons in nature. We were not sitting in home. So I feel that I was greatly privileged and I could not imagine better a childhood than I had.
So I have a question about that upbringing with your dad and the foraging and the being in nature and all the things that you just explained. For one, were you living in a rural area?
Yeah, well, we've been living both in a city and also in a mountains. We had a house in a city where my parents were working, and then most of the time when we had a free time, we went to the mountains. But from my city to the mountains was 20 minutes with bus, so not that far.
Did you divide the time between the mountains and the city, or was there more in one or the other?
Oh, I would say more time in a city, especially when I started to play more basketball or being more involved in a sport. I had to travel so much that eventually kind of the mountain trips, they were less and lesser over the time.
And I'm just wondering what kind of an effect. Say, for example, your dad, who was into the foraging, into nature, as he knew about the animals from a young age. I mean, apart from that being a very natural backdrop and obviously nurturing, I'm anticipating in many different ways. What was something that really stood out from that experience that you could remember? Was it something about thinking, oh, like the resilience that a human being could have in nature? You know, understanding what type of mushroom to eat if you get hungry, or was it more just like, oh, wow, those animals live in this specific way? Was there anything that you can remember about your dad and what he imparted to you in that process that may have had a long-standing impact on you as a person going forward?
I guess there are many stories that I could recall, but maybe some of them is to, you know, when we walk through the forest, and he would explain me how wild pigs would be finding a shelter for themselves in a very harsh winter, and how they would discover that they are naturally created shelters, like there are branches, and these branches are being covered by heavy snow, and so they create some kind of natural caves, and these animals are capable of discovering those affordances that are in the environment, and they harness that kind of opportunities in an environment in a very intelligent way. So something that is, for example, in science being articulated or have been articulated in, for example, by J.J. Gibson. Like that affordances are created in a meeting between you and the environment, what you are capable of seeing in that environment. That kind of was incorporated in me through the experience, not through the books. Or, you know, when we were on a hunt, and I was asking him why he would be killing certain animal and why not killing some other. And I realized that he was capable of sharing with me very powerful stories. He would tell, like, look how that animal coordinates. Does that animal coordinate as a healthy animal or more like a sickly animal? And I said, wow, this is interesting. So he's talking about the health of an animal. He says, look at the territory in which that animal operates. If it's a small territory, if it's always the habitual pathways that they're using and that animal is not exploring as much, that also tells something about their physiology. It's about their health, about their state of being. Or, you know, when he cut the animal and he showed me the liver or the kidneys, and he asked me, can you feel the texture of those organs, right? Or look at the texture of their muscles. So I felt like this is all, he's a medicine man. Of course he's not a doctor, he's not a doctor, but I just feel like when you step into traditional Chinese medicine or Western medicine, everything started somewhere from there, from us being more in connection with nature. And so understand the basics of observation.
That's brilliant. What a brilliant analogy. And I can very much see how that carried through into, you know, particularly a lot of the work that you do in imparting this idea of adaptability into living. And I think we'll hit on some of that later very, you know, respectfully. I mean, I'm sure that there could be a lot of people out there that could relate with that type of an upbringing. I personally didn't have that type of an upbringing. My dad wasn't taking me into the woods and cutting an animal open, asking me to check out the texture of its organs. But I resonate with it. I was a Boy Scout for a while. I'm not really comparable, but the
the analogy that's drawn from that, and look, what you just explained about adaptability, how this animal learns to adapt in the environment, is you know, an underlying theme right now in the predicament that we're in right now, sociopolitically or socioculturally in society. We're being forced to reassess, you know, our position in the world, and also adapt at a fast pace with technology. That's very inspiring, Joseph. That was a great start. So I'd like to go from this sort of kid, you know, with your dad in nature. Like, what happened? What happened immediately after that? Was it immediately sport?
Well, my father always wanted that I'm physically involved. Not only being able to work around the house and dig some holes or some foundations for a fence around our house, or being able to work with wood. He wanted that I would be playing some kind of sport, being engaged with other kids, and maybe be a little bit competitive and see how that goes. But also there was something else in me that was very powerful as a childhood. I always wanted to be an actor, because I was fascinated that I could create a world that does not exist, right? I understood that I can create a world that I like, and I do not have to just sit, be passive, and receive the world that someone dictates for me. I said, okay, I can create a costume. I can create new text. I can create new ideas that haven't been there before. So there were these two parallel streams in my childhood. And that was like, I want to create my own world, not necessarily being an actor, but having that power over the environment, reducing the complexity of the environment by understanding the better the environment and constructing and modeling it in such a way that it would be useful for me. And on the other hand, having sports as another way of coping with the environment. When someone sets the rules, I need to understand those rules and try to excel within that kind of boundary. So there are these two different, not they are opposing world, but they can complement each other. And that's what happened later on in my future, that I nicely, or at least I feel that I greatly benefit from my capacity to stay within the society that was creating a certain rules, but also me creating my own rules and creating the world that I like.
So the rules, let's talk about the rules. And I'm going to just use basketball as an example, because obviously when you're playing basketball, there are a set of rules. And depending on the position that you are, there's also a set of internal rules on your team where, you know, you would have to cooperate with your teammates depending on what your position is in the team to use the embedded rules and an element of creativity to help you guys win the game. So that obviously if the goal was to win and the goal was technique. So within the rules, the rules in basketball, and let's start with that. I mean, because I think it's a good analogy. The basketball rules, there's the rule of the game. And when it comes to what the referee determines is a point or not, then there's the actual rules within the team members and the team spirit. Now, something that is interesting, because team sports usually get lost in this obscurity sometimes, as fantastic and as exciting as they can be. The drive behind team sport that governs this desire to win sometimes throws a bit of a sour taste into the collective team spirit. So I'd like to start first by asking about team rules. When you were playing on your teammates as a whole, in the experience that you had being on your team in basketball or teams or, you know, however many years you played, was there a common understanding of a reciprocation and collaboration and cooperation within the team player rule structure? Let's talk about those rules first.
Yes. Of course there was. You have to act as one organism, but I wasn't a real asshole. You know, I started to play basketball really late and I didn't understand the game very much, but I was so strong and so aggressive that eventually they kind of selected me to a junior national basketball team where I didn't ever attend it because I just quit at that moment. I said, I don't need to do that. I just have to go to art and do whatever I want and no one should be telling me what I should be doing. So in that period, you know, I was relatively okay in basketball because I didn't intend to be amazing in it. I was just playing and I really enjoyed it, and I was not very communicative. But I think we have to do like two or three steps backwards and say, you know, the basic rules that we need to obey is those rules mm-hmm. that are common to all biological systems. And mm-hmm. what is common to all biological systems, all living creatures, is that we try to persist. right? And we try to resist dissipation of the energy. We try to kind of create that autopoietica, as Francisco Varela would be saying, an amazing scientist. He says we are autopoietic system. Autopoetry or autopoiesis is a self-creating system or autopoietic system. And that autopoietic system has a certain autonomy from the external environment and tries to keep its function and its structure intact for at least a certain amount of time in order to persist in quiet fluctuating external environment. So that's a kind of first rule. I try to maintain my stability. I try to maintain my boundaries. And then addition to that, we have a different learned cognitive goals, as for example, being a basketball player. But that underlying rule cannot be ignored. So there is this rule of us trying to maintain our homeostasis, our very narrow range of viability. And then within that very narrow range of viability, within this very kind of constrained phenotype, body type that we have, or our phenotypical construct, we try to create a maximum of freedom. And one of the freedoms would be maybe to express it, let's say, from basketball, but the same rules apply everywhere. We need to maintain the homeostasis, we need to stay alive, and then within the cultural life that we live, we try to excel in different type of rules that are imposed on us. And the question is, are you an animal that is capable of bringing more understanding into the principles and then being more flexible in your behavior, or your behavior is more rigid and creates more conflict with the world that you are meeting in your life?
Well, would it be correct to assume that your departure from basketball had something to do with the fact that being restricted by rules, whether that was socially or as a member of your team and or by the rules of basketball, did you hit the threshold by which you just explained you could understand how to adapt to the point where you learned just as much as you could have, and then you needed to move out of that environment? And so the original question was like the rules among team players. And let me rephrase that, because I mean, a team, and I mean, I'm sure that you find this also in your creative projects, what you, Linda, have been doing and the various different productions and choreographies that you do too. And you work with a team of performance artists and dancers, and you communicate with those dancers, I'm anticipating, in such a way that you have your choreography, and then there's an element probably of malleability in that too, that as you start to create the choreography itself. Maybe the dancer themselves has something interesting that just adaptively adds something to the mix. So back to the basketball, you as a team player in the game, strong, agile, powerful. Did it become limiting because you just saw things in a certain way on how you could implement the technique to get the points and you got bored with it? Or was there adversity among the other team players? And what was it that made you depart?
Well, I was quite pragmatic about it. I said, I started basketball when I was 14 years old, 17 and a half, I finished. And probably the reason was that I once sat and I said, wait a minute, Czechoslovakia was good at basketball, but at that time, I don't think we were as good in a kind of European level. And I said, I don't know what would be the future there. So I have learned quite a lot here. Why not to create a new endeavor and throw myself into art world and see what happens there? And it was an excellent solution excellent choice, which I could not know that was excellent that particular time. It was just a feeling, you know, I just want to go to art world. I just want to study what means acting, what means creating scripts, what means writing, what means design, what means cinematography. I was very much interested in that world because I said, oh, I can offer so much more maybe if I get an opportunity to be creative and not just being in part of maybe a game that someone has created somewhere. But that doesn't mean that I diminish anyone spending all their life dedicated something to basketball. I just felt at that moment it was a good departure. I think I've done what I should, and then I was interested in some other things. When I was accepted in art school, which was 17 and a half, let's say almost 18 years old, I clearly knew that I'm going to leave and I'm going to put all my attention there. So I went to acting department, and you know, I wanted to learn absolutely everything. I wanted to be a stuntman. I had my physique. I said I can do anything for, you know, like stunt scenes. I wanted to know how to sing. I wanted to know how to act. I could, how to be anyone in the world. I wanted to be skilled how to pretend. But I met a very inspiring figure in an art school, which was later on also my tutor in my PhD studies. And that was my teacher, Lyudmila Machachova. And she said to me, Josef, you do not have to learn all of those different things. You really only need to learn one thing. And that one thing that you need to learn is how to sound as yourself. And looking at it backwards, I said, wow, she is so smart. She was so smart because she said something really, really important. You know, above Apollon's cave is written, know yourself, right? Then later on, Descartes, he said, I'm thinking, therefore I am. Then later on, after Husserl, Immanuel Kant, Husserl, Ponty in France, we say, not what I know, but if I can do, right? And I say, well, that's not enough, because you can do a lot of things, but also destroy yourself. Mm-hmm. But if you say, how do I sound as me, means how am I authentic to myself? How do I sound in movement? How do I sound in communication? How do I sound in relation to the world? And that was so beautiful. That was really a changing, really changing moment in my life.
The teacher that you're talking about, we had this conversation before, I think when you were in Tokyo, she was the communication teacher. She was the one that was helping you to like voice projection, communication, composure, that teacher.
Yeah. So Lyudmila Makhachova, her role in the university was to teach voice for basically anyone who does public speaking, right? So her role was to teach voice, but voice, you cannot teach voice alone. You cannot teach breathing alone. That's ridiculous. So she's, let's say we can call her a communication trainer. Communication trainer is that you want to say something. Are you able to express it? Are you able to express it with clarity? Are you able to be heard? Are you able to express yourself with the richness of your tonality, with a voice that belongs to you, that you do not pretend or assume you have a certain role in life, but you are more you. You are more, yes, as I said, authentic to yourself. And that was our main contribution to development also of the entire, what we now call, fighting monkey practice or research.
From that point, or did that, had you already started to be, to get into contemporary dance still while you were doing that? Or did you depart from that, go to contemporary dance? I mean, where did contemporary dance come into the picture? I mean, I know there's a lot to cover there, but I like to tie these things together. I'd like to see if there's any kind of thread whatsoever.
I don't know how people connect me to the contemporary dance or dancing in general, right? There must be some, I don't know where that comes from, but when I finished my regular studies in university, then I was looking for a job that wouldn't be linked only to words, right? I didn't like play drama theater necessarily, you know. I didn't want to be linked again. I didn't want to be limited by one nation. I didn't want to be limited to my language only. I said, I need to travel the world. For me at the time, it was really important that I discover the world. So I would do anything in the world to travel. I needed to see new cultures. I needed to see new people. I needed to hear how is the perspective from other points of view. So this was like main interest. And so I was saying, is there any type of theater that I could participate in that would not be linked to only my language? And somehow through that kind of search, I started to do more physical theater. Mm-hmm. I could never dance, but because of my athletic background, because of my acting background, because of my interest in theater, I got job in many different companies, and some of them, basically I got a job in three companies, but they were world-known companies, so I could travel as a actor, mover in let's say companies that are more engaged in contemporary art, not only contemporary dance. But I would not call myself dancer, because then I would insult all the dancers.
But that's interesting. That so I have a couple of questions for you. So I think rewinding back to university, I'll come back to the dance thing in a second. I understood that totally. So I guess for one, you'd be better described as a physical theater artist. So would that be correct? Or
yeah, would be, yes.
So you went to the university to learn to do things, you know, everything specifically, but you learned that you need to learn to be yourself, you mentioned. So what does that mean exactly?
Oh, well, what does that mean? Looking at it from now, from my age, being almost 50 years old, being you is just, yeah, being you, it really, I think that there's no better sentence than really sounding the best as you. When you coordinate, when you move, when you play basketball, when you do boxing, when you do wrestling, if you do it rightly, it looks right, it sounds right. If you speak and you do not lie or do not pretend, it has all the variety. It has beautiful tonality. It has beautiful music. It has beautiful variations. As soon as you start to lie to yourself, there is some kind of rigidity that is being introduced. And that applies not only to speaking, but it applies also to movement. It applies to cooking. That applies to anything. So being authentic to yourself is, I guess, your capacity to sometimes very intelligently change the hypothesis about the world that you have, or slightly change the action about the world in order to minimize the errors that you are creating. So I guess is it someone who doesn't become loyal to one idea, doesn't mm-hmm. become loyal to one system, doesn't become loyal to, oh, this is what I stand for and I'm never going to change it, or this is how I'm going to act in a world and this is the right way. I guess it is sounding well is becoming humble and understand that the world is fluctuating, you are fluctuating. And so you cannot have a one answer to the world, whatever that would be, maybe yoga, tai chi, boxing, jiu-jitsu, wrestling, it doesn't matter. Those systems are maybe useful for a certain amount of time, maybe for your whole life, but we cannot assume that they will be useful for our whole life. We need to really interact with the world, and the world itself is our feedback. And from every single encounter in the world, we have opportunity to learn. World is for us the greatest playground to learn and improve our hypothesis of the world or our actions in the world.
So based on what you just said right now, why is it that you could never dance?
Well, I didn't say that I cannot dance. I could move in some way, but maybe in a, listeners, they understand probably dance as ballet, or they understand it as a break dancing, or they understand it as some kind of style. I do not have any of those style. What I have mm-hmm. is that maybe I can represent with my body without speech. I can tell a story. Right. Or I can adapt. So if I work with someone who is a contemporary dancer, I can adjust my movement by being capable of learning to belong to that kind of expression, but never really being a perfect in any of those techniques. Right. This is more like I am capable of being on the stage and share story with you. That doesn't matter if I'm a public speaker, if I have to present you a scientific research, or if I have to present you a poem from some great author, if I have to tell you my own story or story of someone else, I am capable of doing that. That's what I was interested in, being capable of telling the story in some way, being able to inspire you, to move you, to move you, yes, maybe inspire you to do something else or look at the world in a different way.
In relation to being yourself and then everything you just explained about dance, the perspective that you have on, say, for example, the necessity of trying different things and not to be rigidly held back by following one discipline or one way of training or one specific modality of performance. Were those things that you just said in being yourself somehow adapting to this idea of performance and creation?
Yeah. Look, the principle is simple. You can exist only if you find the information that is missing for you. If you cannot find the information that is missing, you cannot exist. We constantly, as a living creatures, we try to reduce the uncertainty, right? Your organism is missing something. Something broke in your organism, whatever, a tissue broke, or a certain relation broke, or you got lost in a space for some reason. Are you able to find your way back? Are you able to find your resources? Are you able to find the relations that will help you to overcome the troubles you appear to be in? So this is what we are doing. This is our main motivation for living creatures, to maintain our existence, to self-evidence ourselves, as Carl Friston would say. So my practice and my research is guided by information is missing. Are you able to find that information that is missing? If you are capable of doing that, you will always be successful.
I'd like to use coordination as an example, because it's something that is so central to the Fighting Monkey practice, working with coordinations. And I mean, yeah. that coordination
yeah.
requires, if someone, you know, in how I experience Fighting Monkey, and I'm sure how a lot of people will, there's a certain fundamental approach that you have to building the structure and coordination, which is very linear. And that's, I've experienced that with you. But I also have experienced the idea of this, and again, maybe this could be metaphorically transferred into what you just said. Once you understand the basic rules of the coordination tactics or techniques, then you start to see all the different variable possibilities that expand beyond the structure of coordination. Would that be one example that defines this, what you're saying? And would you have anything to comment about that? Because there's a few things that you do. You drill in Fighting Monkey. People come to your workshops. They work with you. And one of the things that is very, very seriously and in-depthly worked on is coordinations and the variable different expanding possibilities.
I don't know what you mean by linear structure, but we can let that on the side. So if you look at a good football player, if you look at a good basketball player, if you look at a good wrestler, a good boxer, if you look at someone who does weightlifting, if they do not have a perfect coordination or they are not well coordinated according to their constitution, there is no way they can produce such a beautifully, athletically inspiring performances. So if there is no coordination, there is no performance. This is being kind of pushed on the side. You know, when the athlete has a problem and the athlete gets injured, where he is going to be sent? To strength conditioning trainer or some kind of rehabilitation. But no one is really looking, no one has a time to look on how do we coordinate in life. That does not necessarily only mean how do I coordinate my body. I think it means how do I coordinate my energy with circadian rhythms? How do I coordinate my action in relation to other people? How do I coordinate my speech in dialogue? How do I coordinate my body when I run? Or how do I coordinate my body when I'm working with opponent on an athletic field?
Would it be correct to assume that the things that you're referring to here, and I'm with you on that, what I meant by linear was obviously every athlete, and I mean, we tend to agree and disagree on this. We've had many conversations about it. Every athlete, some people you could say are more gifted than others. Some people, maybe the upbringing, again, maybe that has to do with the fact that you were in the woods, you know, with your dad foraging, looking at the variable different dynamic aspects of nature allowed for you to be more resiliently adaptable than most people. But obviously, you know, you trained in basketball, obviously your departure from basketball, maybe it had something to do with the fact that people wanted to put you in a box. I'm not sure if that's what it was or not. When it comes to linear structure, and I just want to iterate on that for a second, what I meant to say by that is that there are certain, and in the coordinations in Fighting Monkey, for the people that know what I'm talking about, and for the people that don't know what I'm talking about, you'd have to go to a Fighting Monkey workshop where they're working on coordinations to understand. So the coordinations, there are various different moves with the arms and with the legs as a primary foundation in the structure of the coordinations. So what I mean by that is that you're learning those things the same. You repeat those things, you're showing people, you slow it down. So there's a part of that, which is like the first aspect of it is linear. So what I'm saying is, what I mean by linear is that the actual dynamic of it is not linear, but what happens is that those patterns that everybody learns first are the same. Everybody follows the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
I get it.
So in the same thing for being an athlete, athlete, a musician, when people are learning how to play scales or when they're learning how to sort of do specific techniques in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, when it comes to grappling, wrestling, there's certain names for things, how you approach the name, do those, all that's linear. Then you become Rickson Gracie. At one point he starts to innovate, you know, and then the innovation off the linear structure. And I understand that what you're talking about. So that's what I meant by linear first and foremost. So you want to comment on that?
This is nice. Well, basically, look, we need to obey the physics and we need to obey the biological rules. And we have a certain phenotype, so we have a certain structure that we need to understand. Even within our phenotypes as human beings, there are quite nice, interesting differences that we need to incorporate in our training, and they have to be understood and nourished in some way. Once we understand the basics, how we can harness what was given to us, the degrees of freedom that our body has, how we can harness energy, how we can transfer that energy through our bodies, it's like understanding a grammar or understanding technique on piano. Once you get that, you can play whatever music in the world you like. So it's basically like stepping to the valley from which you can explore any mountains around you. And what I'm interested in is really becoming my personal kind of motivation is that can I share knowledge with my students in such a way that they can become independent from me? That once they learn those principles, that they will be able to create their own poetry because they do understand the grammar. If they understand the grammar, they can create their own writing. They do not have to rewrite the same book that I wrote. This would be the most horrible thing that could happen in my life. I don't want anyone doing what I'm doing. I will never tell you do what I'm doing, because the reason why I'm doing certain things in my life is because it is contextualized. It is because it belongs to my life and what I'm meeting in life. What I'm sharing with you is my creative thinking and my thought process in trying to understanding how I analyze science, or how I apply certain information from science, or how I apply creativity into life, etc. But not repeating what I'm doing. That's horrible. So it's like when you see these systems that are being created and they say, this is the right system. This is the biggest lies we have created in our cultural lives.
That's interesting. And I mean, the perception of the perception of the rigidity in a system too, I think has a lot to be examined, because, you know, as what you just explained right now, a system in itself almost becomes a parody or redundant in itself. So at a certain point in time, we reach proficiency or skill. Then at that point, it's either adapt and create, or, you know, modify or move on to the next experience. And whatever that experience could be, it could be something that is very nonlinear in its process. And I guess maybe I'd just like to jump a little bit back to your creative process. Like, so we move away now a bit for the time being from your being an educator. And I have to say that even though I understand everything that you say about not wanting your students to build the dependency on you, you have a lot of students out there that are very dependent on what you impart. And I don't see that as a negative thing. I see that as a positive. I mean, the overdependence is where there's a problem. When students start to glory, and this, I'm not speaking about you specifically, I'm just speaking about myself from the position of an education, and I teach a system which I've created, but there's an underlying factor in that system identical to what you're talking about here, whereas it comes to a point where if people cannot use what they've learned in my system and adapt it to something else that they're doing in their life in a creative way, then there's no point really for them to continue to do it. I mean, if there's not something that allows for them to be able to use that as a tool to explore something, as you said, which would be more creative, that'd be great. But your students do depend on you, Joseph. I mean, they depend on you for guidance because of everything that you represent in the dynamic aspects of your life. And I'd like to pull that a little bit of that in right now, because, you know, one thing is that your background in athletics, you went on to do your art HD or your PhD, but you referred to it as an art HD in Slovakia, where your teacher taught you about communication skills and building that. Then you went off into creation when it comes to, if you want to refer to it as physical theater, I don't know. I don't necessarily want to throw labels out there, physical mm-hmm. theater. Mm-hmm. You were performing in Ultima Veth for years. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about that particular performance, but that's very well known in the contemporary art / physical theater world. Now, yeah. in that yeah. particular, so yeah. I want to know first, did the choreographer allow for there to be a certain amount of dynamic stuff happening among the performers that were in that and touring in that production?
Yeah, he's a great guy. The guy who's leading Ultima Veth is Wim van de Kebusen. Yes. He's as wild as crazy and as gets, you know, I don't know if he's constantly on drugs. Of course he's not, because he's not true. But he's like, he just collects the wild animals and he let them free and then just arrange it a little bit. And he's smart arranging it in such a way that it can become very popular and successful shows. But it's really, you know, you should be in our surrounding. You know, they go all the weird stories about, you know, what's going on in that company or what was going on in that company at the time when we've been there. But yes, it was like really powerful people from different backgrounds going crazy. And he, crazy as well, he kind of can give a shape to that craziness in such a way that people in the theater as an audience could identify with that madness and kind of, wow, be taking on a journey with us. So I had an absolute freedom. And this man, anyone I met in my life, my great teacher, and I cannot give more respect to him and to all other people, like to you. I mean, you are appearing in FM stories also. You know, our small journey in Tokyo. It's in now in the canonical stories of FM. You know, so I have masters everywhere, and he like you and many other people are my masters that taught me something very valuable about life. So he gave me a great opportunity to perform that I would otherwise never have.
So, I mean, that transferred, Joseph, when you left that, you went on to do a lot of very interesting stuff, both in the world of, you know, performance art and installation art. So the installation art thing is something that I'm quite interested in talking to you about, because you've done very visceral installation art projects with materials, and then those materials themselves also found their way into the I'm not sure to what extent you're still using those materials in Fighting Monkey workshops, because it's not always so viable to bring like fucking you know, like 30 kilograms of clay into a room and put it onto the floor and let everybody play with it for 2 days. And I mean, but those physical material, the installations that you went on to this, like it was a form of expression through art in some of the installations that you did. Working with people in a dynamic environment to working with massive pieces of fucking wood and like, you know, like doing something with them structurally. And I mean, maybe this carries a little mm-hmm. bit into the concept of earthquake architecture when it comes to the Fighting Monkey practice as well, mm-hmm. too, when it comes to stability, fragility. So can you give us an mm-hmm. example of one thing mm-hmm. that you did with big materials by yourself and became an installation? So if you've resonated so far with any of the topics discussed, please consider sharing it with others and clicking the like button. This is really going to help more people find it and support all the efforts that go into this production. Your being here to check out this episode today is a massive contribution toward the sharing of ideas that unfold in these talks, and thank you very much for your support. And subscribe to get real-time notifications about all upcoming episodes.
Yeah, so first I have to tell to all the listeners that... Yeah, okay, I'm a little bit known in art, but nothing spectacular, right? So I'm not number one world-known artist, just that they know, because my interest is everywhere. I do, as much as I love art, I do also some other things. So just that you do not make me bigger than I am, this is very important for me. But what I kind of like very much is that the, you know, our language, even our spoken language, depends on our actual capacity to interact with the environment. And when we sculpt the environment sculpts us in return. So the materials you embrace, the materials you work with, there's kind of reciprocal relations. And so I know if I spend considerable amount with wrestlers, my body will be resculpted in a certain way. My brain will be resculpted in a certain way. If I work with the wood and I understand the quality of the wood, I will probably be capable of understanding something about life. But also I will be able to understand something about my liver. If you talk about the traditional Chinese medicine, I will probably be able to understand something about fascia. I will be also able to understand something about ecology. One of the very... very powerful stories in my life is that I had woods where I spend and I would not pray, but where I would contemplate about life, right? And those woods, they got sick, and I was ruined by seeing that those trees are dying. And and you know, that very strong connection to the world material, like a clay, like a wood, like a water, or whatever that I use in art, but also in our training, it's because I am in absolute love with nature. And when we're destroying it, I feel pain. Yeah, I feel very, very clear pain. When you cut the tree, I feel something very powerful, right? And so I'm using this material. I'm using wood. I'm using, let's stay with the wood, clay, and water, so we do not overcomplicate this discussion. But I was working with the logs, wooden logs that are 70
big
kilograms
logs.
Heavy and
big logs.
Big logs. Yeah. And I had I cannot remember. I think I have 70 pieces of them. And I was for several hours creating a different composition with them. So I was just basically carrying like a weightlifter, the wooden blocks. And I was just trying to create new and new compositions, compositional structures. So I can imagine you go to a museum, but you see one particular perfect composition that artist wants his audience to see. But I was interested in creating an endless amount of composition, to prove that any composition is right, that there is no one privileged composition. And so that was one piece that I've done. So, you know, I was happy about it because I also worked out quite well. So the people that like weightlifting, they say, oh, that was a good work that I could do as well. So on that side, you know, I felt really physical. And that physicality allowed me to change my state of mind. So after 3 hours of lifting 70 kilogram wooden beams over and over again, you can imagine what happens to the body. So body's exhausted, the sugar is gone, your brain is gone, your thoughts are gone, and something magical can happen in those moments. So these are a kind of compositional structures where you have something solid. But when you work with clay, what is beautiful about the clay is that every touch changes it, and that represents more like your mind. If you work with your brain, then the plasticity remains. If you stop to work, if you assume that you will keep that kind of idea about the world, then it ossifies, then the clay becomes like a rock, and eventually it will become like a powder. And so we use this material to kind of express a certain, let's say, neuroplasticity, or we try to explain something about life and communication. So we use these materials to have more quality materials to enhance our ability to communicate with the diversity of the world.
It's interesting. I'm just curious. I just recently came across this, what you're explaining to me about working with the big logs. I came across, somebody shared something with me on YouTube recently about some Scandinavian kid that got fed up with, I think he was Scandinavian anyway. He got fed up with living in, wherever he was living. Oh, yeah, maybe he's Swedish. Yeah. So he got fed up of living in Stockholm. Young kid, 16, 17 years old. So he just fucking went to his grandparents' land somewhere in the forest. So he also filmed himself. He did everything, and mostly with hand tools. So hand drills, hatchets, you know, to carve out the joints for the logs, wooden nails. I think he even forged his own steel nails at some point. I think I remember seeing that. And he talks about it, the experiences. For one, there's no narrative in the entire video. And if you haven't seen it, I'll share it with you, and also share it in the show notes here. He talks in the liner notes about there being so much adversity in the process of what he did. He knew nothing. So basically, he was working with the stuff, making mistakes all the time. And what drove him was he was fed up with material aspects of living in the world, and he went off into nature to do these things. It sounds almost altruistic or idealistic, but there's a part of it which rang very true to me anyway. What he explained about adversity was, I'm a big proponent of, without adversity, you're not going to get anything in life. I mean, we have to have some sort of a challenge. The adversity of making mistakes, the adversity of working, like he's showing pictures of himself, like tying ropes, like when he's hoisting the logs up to the higher levels of the wall in building the structure of the cabin. He's got these pulleys that he's made of rope and wood, and he's sort of churning the thing up these other two pieces of wood so that they roll up, and it's just himself, a skinny kid, pulling these things up to allow them to fit into the joint of the thing. And you can imagine how many times he let that drop, because it's such a fine tuned process of making sure that the balance of weight within the position of gravity, rolling up the two pieces of thing to sit into those joints. And actually that experience reminded me very much of watching that, you know, or seeing photographs of what you did with those big pieces of wood, and that adverse, but comparably, somehow primal, you know, experience of working with big pieces of wood like that. I can understand from what we've spoken about in the past, and from what this kid was able to do, how that would affect somebody. And now I want to take this back a little bit to the, you know, the fighting. When I first was turned on to Fighting Monkey, it was through that video that the fighting monkey video that went viral. I think it was 2015.
Shala did amazing job. Yeah,
she did amazing job. So that in that video, but there was no clay in that video. And when I was watching that video, it was just all you guys hanging out in some the mountainside in Greece, and you know, you were talking a lot about the, you know, Linda's great grandmother or something was 90 years old, and she still had to, you know, in order to live her life, you know, there was no tools or workers or people she could hire. Basically, she's just pulling branches off the trees. She could feed the goats so they could churn the butter and they can eat the dairy. And so it's all like very, it's very practical and practical aspects of living your life. And but that explanation that you gave about working with what you have in order to be able to survive and having that stimulate you know, the brain and the body in such a way that it's still 93 years old, you're still pulling the branches of the fucking trees, right? That then I saw, like, I got inspired. And then that's when we first started our communication. I think it first time I reached out to you, maybe it was in 2015 at some point. And then I watched the next video. And then I forgot when the next one was. You're all working with clay and picking up big pieces of clay too. Like, so there's all this, you know, there's elements of like this, the fitness community and kettlebells and functional fitness and blah, blah, blah. And you guys are picking up big pieces of clay, which I'm anticipating there were probably about maybe 20, 30 kilograms and fucking throwing them down onto the floor. And just like, man, everybody's covered in clay, like, and it's just like dirty clay all over everybody. Like a slipping, sliding. And that visceral experience of what you're just explaining. I mean, that doesn't happen currently too often, does it? In fighting workshops, is it hard to coordinate that stuff?
No, it's happening. It's happening. You just haven't been in other intensives, because this is always happening more in intensives than in other workshops. Yes, we used to have it in our annual meetings where we can experiment, do crazy stuff, and then see how people respond. And it's basically va-bang, you know, like if we introduce these things, are we going to lose all our followers or... You know, so it's always on the edge. Like, do people really think that we are absolutely crazy, or we are just joking with them, or is this for real? You know, in me there is no conflict between weightlifting, kettlebell, and clay and wood. It doesn't really matter. I love kettlebells. I love weightlifting. I love all of that. These are tools that we can be using freely the way we like. You know, this is what I learned in art. I will never say like this is bad and this is good and I limit myself. I say whatever is useful to you, just use it. But be smart so you do not become overly loyal to one idea, because you might run in trouble over a longer period of time. Just look at the evolution. You will see if you overly fit to one domain or one environment, when a rapid changes happens, you will not be ready to respond. So I am more interested in not committing to one thing so much, and as much I basically play more, and I don't care too much about how much this will have any practical application or how that will turn out into being a great business or whatever. We have like two classes of actions. One is pragmatic actions and epistemic actions, and the pragmatics are those that try to get us somewhere. We want to get from it, I don't know, money or fame or whatever. But I'm very much tuned into epistemic valued action, which is just exploration for the sake of exploration. You know, even when you look at the research and you have rats in a maze searching for food, they know it and they discover where their food constantly is, but they also get bored. They also want to explore the rest of the maze just for the sake of exploration, because that allows you to probably find something maybe greater. So I'm looking at, okay, I have a good solution in life. Can I find better? And so this is more what I do. When people sometimes ask me, you know, can you enhance this performance or can you enhance this other thing? You know, I can say, yes, we can play together and try to find out if there would be any value in what we are doing to your life. And if not, then it's fine. I'm too tired of promising anything to anyone. It's just, I can't do that. I don't want to say to people that I'm doing this or that and then not deliver. So I would say that what we do mainly is to play and explore the opportunities in life. Because one thing that we focus on in a modern culture is resilience, you know, adaptability, resilience, etc. But, you know, your energy is declining day by day. There is always increasing entropy. There is always the second law of thermodynamics that eventually makes you evaporate. You will disappear. But creativity or your capacity to find opportunities in your dynamic environment, that's an art that will allow you, even with less energy resources or even with older age, you can still explore the world and enjoy the quality of the world. I see so many men, I hear so many podcasts, how people try to stay young, how people try to maintain their muscular, whatever volume. Their unfulfilled lives are pushing them there. What's the problem with wrinkles? What's the problem with aging? What's the problem with disappearance? Give place to other people, please. And yeah, okay, but maybe I'm drifting into another area.
That's a whole other discussion. I mean, and that's something that I think is very interesting, because that in part is driven predominantly by information technology and social media, and the fact that we're missing out on what we feel we should be doing in life. But an underlying theme in what you do in Fighting Monkey, and this is the archetypal thing that one would always hear you say in a workshop, or that has been said in some of the media that you guys release, is what kind of games can you play to stay young? And so this is like, and that concept of staying young, I'm anticipating this ties into this concept of the malleability of the working with clay, like neuroplasticity. So that is, I'm guessing that's the reference point in relation to games and adversity. Okay, so what I see is that there's a certain level of and again, this is something I just like to pick apart, because again, some people will know what you do, some people won't know what you do. So this is part of like trying to help people mm-hmm. understand the you're obviously not putting anybody into some kind of dangerous adverse situation, but on the other hand, you're giving them a series of different tasks to be able to experiment with. I was going to say accomplish, but it's not really about accomplishment, really. Is it? It's just about the ability to put yourself in that situation, whether it's working with little pieces of wood and trying to find an agile a set of moves enough to be able to sort of work around these little pieces of wood, which are so fragile and they can fall over, or whether it's working with the dragon pearl, which is like an 8 or 10 kilogram, carved wooden ball, and fucking throwing it across the room to somebody else and hoping that they can catch it with one hand, which is another great Fighting Monkey video by, that came not too far along from the clay mess video. I mean, so these are games that not only help you stay young, but they're also games that would help you to stay sharp and resilient.
Yeah. For the audience, just that they understand what is it that we are doing. So if you say that the adaptive systems, they try to maintain their viability to stay within the range of certain homeostasis, what they are doing, basically, they try to engage with the world through some kind of perception action loop, right? That's how we control the environment. Better you control the environment, better you are able to reduce the complexity of the environment, higher the chances of your survival are. Better you can play with what surrounds you, basically. But what I have added to this perception action loop, I have added two elements. One element is what I call zero forms. Zero mm-hmm. represents zero entropy, so you would become immortal, which is impossible, right? But anyway, zero forms, which is a set of physical questions, a set of questions where we studying your effect of your communication on your physiology, right? So we keep your hypothesis of the world, and we testing through interoception, proprioception. We try to test what's the effect of your everyday life on your joints, on your organs, on your mind. How do you coordinate? What is your autobiography? What is your coordination? What is your voice, etc.? Which makes you to understand what information is missing. So why you're aging the way you are aging. Once you know what information is missing, once you understand better, you have better understanding, because you're sampling through zero forms your internal states, you better understand then what the world is and what is the quality of your communication. Once you know what information is missing, you then change your perception. And by changing your perception, you are moving the world in a different way. And what we added between perception and action, we have added another element, which we call movement situation, which means, in other words, simulation of life. Which can be which is basically your capacity to model the world before you meet the world. What does that mean? It means that the basketball player does training before it goes to play basketball match. When you go to do a new shoe, you want to design a new shoe, you are going somewhere, you take the leather, you get the experts on design, you get the experts on marketing. You're basically able to model what you would like to do in the future. And you are able to model various futures, so you can create different hypotheses from which you can choose what would be the best strategies. And that's in these two domains, I've spent a considerable amount of time. So what you would be learning with us in a movement situation is your capacity to model the world in a different ways. So then you can have a more repertoire to act in the world that is dynamic. So you do not have only one strategy, but on the go, you can also create another alternative strategy, so you can possibly create alternative futures for you, which is extremely important, because usually the world doesn't go as we predicted it. There is never a plan. There is always B or C or D, and there is always something that would be a trouble. So in FM research, what we are doing, we are very actively searching for what information we are missing, how we can gain back that information, and how we can improve our communication with the world. And this can be done through many different forms of modeling the world.
Can you give me an example of how one would adopt that curriculum or that experience and take it back out into something practical? And when I mean practical, a lot of what you just said, it's very interesting. So how can we give somebody out there the perspective? Like if somebody comes from an A type of life, they get into the FM material, zero forms, practical application. How can they take that and apply it back to A life to make the B scenario, if that makes any sense? I mean, so can you give me can you give the listeners or the viewers out there some sort of really practical, easy to understand example of what they're gonna take from Fighting Monkey experience back out into the world, into what they do in their lives?
So I'm interested in creating a life supporting practice. That's my main interest. So the life supporting practice is the practice that allows you to communicate better in the world in a context which you operate. So the main theme is quest for better communication. Can you communicate better? Can you exchange better the information with the environment that surrounds you, on which your autonomy depends? Okay, so that's like that's an umbrella for it. Now, any system that supports life needs to be capable to give you a feedback on where you are. If it cannot give you a feedback, it's not a good system. Now, the question would be, not yoga, not Tai Chi, not Pilates, not Feldenkrais, not Alexander Technique, not stretching this or that, but do you have the grammar, do you have the understanding how to sample your internal states? Means, can you understand in which state you are, which kind of physiological state you are? Are you capable to understand what kind of autobiography you create? So what is your what is your territory within which? Okay, back so I can explain better. But I do not want to go too much in depth.
Go for
any
it.
Any system that likes to support, any system that tries to support life needs to help you to understand what's the effect of your communication in the world. How we can do it? We can do it through questioning of in which territory you operate, so which kind of world you have constructed for you. Without locating you, without knowing where you are, I cannot help you. So first thing is a questioning of what is the environment you're part of? What are the demands of that environment? How you respond to that demands? And what kind of consequences that kind of response will create in the long run? Number one. That's a number one questioning. So I locate you. I locate who Patrick is or who you are. Where do you operate? Without knowing that, I cannot offer to you anything. Secondary, we need to question what are your internal states? What is your physiological state? What is your level of viability? What does that mean? When we talk about homeostasis, we talk about attractive states within which we can stay alive. But we have to be careful here. Homeostasis is an active state, not passive state. So it is like holding a ball on top of the mountain. And more energy you spend holding your physiology on top of that mountain, more easily you age, more easily you will get into trouble. So I'm asking, how much energy it costs you to stay within your viable range of homeostasis? Which means that there is no system in the world that will bring you more in balance. Because if you're alive, you are in balance. If you're out of balance, you're dead. So the question is, how much energy do you spend to stay alive? That means I need to understand
what is the state of your joints, what is the state of your organs, what is your state of your nervous system. We have a different forms of physical questionings where we can have quite nice, interesting assessment where you probably are. Then we have a questioning about your coordinations. Coordinations in philosophically, we say coordinations, your sleeping patterns, your coordination with the environment, but also how do you coordinate as a human being, right? As the living structure. Then we asking question about improvisation, which means what? Within the territory in which you operate, are you able to see things from different angles, situations from different angle? And if this doesn't bring enough of solutions, are you capable of exploring new territories, go beyond of what you already know? And the last question in Zero Forms is, how can you communicate your experience, your ideas, how you basically share your experience, how you express yourself towards the others? Because this is extremely important. You depend on other people. You are through other people. So your capacity to communicate is very, very important. So Zero Forms is questioning who you are. So what is your autobiography? What is the state of your viability? How do you coordinate? How do you move and improvise? And how do you express yourself? So these are five questions. I try to be clear, but in very short time. On the other hand, we are also questioning how you are capable to model the world. I give you an example. You are going to meet someone for a very important business meeting. I don't know if this is a good example, but let's say this is a good example. And you say, okay, where am I going to meet that person? I do not know that person, so I'm not really sure. It should be long meeting. My door should be open. It can be shorter, it can be long. Okay, I meet that person for a coffee. Okay. Coffee place is good because it can be for short time or it can be for longer time. Because if I invite that person for a dinner, you know, until we order, until we get the food, it can be too long, it can be too awkward. So I say, okay, coffee is good place. Now, which coffee place I will choose? So which means which set I will choose, where I will position myself in that coffee place, what I will be wearing, what will be the nature of our communication. So you model the world. And as you are modeling it, maybe in your head, you are better prepared for that actual action. But you can also not do it only in your head. You can actually do it in some kind of matrix space, which can do it in a white space or a black space, like in a Matrix movie. So I basically have a space, empty space. What I own is empty space in which I can simulate anything. You want to be a better boxer? We can create a simulation. We can first understand we need to locate you. We have to understand what information you are missing as a boxer, as an athlete or whatever you are, what we think is missing in your performance. And then we model the world in such a way that we can find that information. And with that information, you can then more successfully communicate with the demanding environment that you meet in actual life.
That's a fantastic example of the metaphorical transformation of what you're doing. I think we're on very similar trajectories in that way with the work that we're doing, because a practice and the multitude of different experiences that help you to understand. And I like what you said about the state of internal organs, and you know, this would fall into the interoceptive properties of learning, where we start to become aware of, you know, the fine tunings of the body, you know, sensation in relation to the environment that we're in. And I think that that's something that's quite interesting. And that may seem a little bit obscure and abstract for some people, but it's quite important when you're, and this is something also that's borrowed from martial arts, also borrowed from yoga. I say these Eastern practices, we're already starting to explore these ideas about, okay, so what do these subtle moves that we that we're working towards, how are they affecting the body on the subtle structure of the body function? And back then, I don't think it was so much we think about, well, there's going to be a yin deficiency, and this is what we're going to be doing in our Tai Chi practice to sort of balance that yin deficiency and this type of move, and we're going to bring strength to the legs, and that'll bring a little bit more of a yang energy up into the spleen and liver, and that's going to sort everything out. Look, I'm saying, but you understand, from the perspective of traditional Chinese medicine, there's a lot of reference to this. I have a great teacher in Japan, I think. I never got a chance to introduce you to him when you were in Tokyo. His name's Edward Obaidi. Shout out to him. He's a fantastic, he was an acupuncturist, and I was going to him for many years. Whenever I get stuck, he would work on me, give me some needles and moxibustion. I mean, got to a certain point that the conversations that we had during the session were fueling the outcome of the session. So it wasn't so much that he was giving me a needle that was going to help with some imbalance that I was having at that point in time. He says, give me a needle. And we were talking about a perception of an experience. I would share with him things I was experiencing. He would talk to me a perception of the experience. Well, how you perceive the experience, to what extent you can still be resilient if you're on top of the mountain, as you said, without stagnating and be able to transfer that level of resiliency to other stuff. This is what's going to determine, for one, your vitality, and two, your ability to adapt to different situations. I think that that's a fantastic example and very practical. So for people out there who entrepreneurs, maybe you want to join a Fighting Monkey workshop on the level of, say, for somebody like in, correct me if I'm wrong with this, on the level of somebody that I would say like an athlete, like if somebody comes in, they're a professional, just give me an example, figure skater. Okay. So, and they want to come into the Fighting Monkey practice. How's a figure skater going to understand from how it's going to help from an interception for an example here. When they become aware of their internal organ structure, what that actually means to their body and perception, how's the figure skater going to go back to their figure skating game and improve it?
It's a very interesting question, Patrick. You know, why would be working with professional athletes? The only reason for you to work with professional athletes is fame and money. Otherwise, you would never engage because, you know, they are just being exploited for a very short time and then they are being kicked out because they cannot perform for a very long time. So they're really, really, if someone, you know, I was working for a hockey team or whatever, development for basketball coaches, etc. But if really why you are going there, because you're in some way, there is money and because there is a fame. But I don't know how the skater would help, how I would help the skater. If everything works well, I don't have to be there. And if in case that there would be an athlete that would feel that would need that kind of help, then in any case, we need to collaborate always with an experts from their field, because you cannot assume, no matter how kind of master you are, you cannot understand what the subtleties of boxing, subtleties of wrestling, subtleties of skating, subtleties of whatever. You cannot understand it. Even if this is my profession, even if I spend 30 years or studying human communication, coordination, their performance, etc., I cannot understand the beauty and the details of those particular sports. But in collaboration with those experts, their trainers, their choreographers, their strength conditioning trainers, you can add a certain quality inside. What can happen? If a skater or a boxer or anyone feels better their body, they have better control over their body, they can more contribute to the process of development. But the why I would not suggest people coming to FM when they are professional athletes, it's not because I do not want to have them there, but they do not have the time to sense themselves. They are young enough to overcome whatever obstacles. They will be dealing with the troubles when they finish their careers, and that's the time to come to us.
That's it.
Because when you are in a top of, when you are in top of your athletics, there are drugs, there are supplements, there are people that give them constantly. So they do not have to feel them, because physios will feel them better. Or whatever. But you have, of course, you have those intelligent athletes, and there are many of them, that they can, even without having that education, they feel themselves well. That's why they're excellent in their sports, right? I think the pace is so high that this type of education that I offer is, I cannot teach it to you in 1 week or 12 weeks. So if you would be expecting a fast results, I'm not sure I could deliver. Maybe I could. But I would never promise them to you. So those that they can promise a good results are those people that are with them. And there is a good reason that every athlete, they have their teams. So I would never mess with them. But if they would find anything valuable in what we do, I would be more than happy to help. And that's why I was invited in certain occasions to work with certain athletes or certain teams to help with something. But I would maybe not do it on a regular basis. That's not where my interest is.
There's a lot of athletes that have given great testimonials to the work that they've done with you and Fighting and Linda and other FM teachers. One of the reasons why I brought that out is because those athletes are saying things in their testimonials that where they can carry back into the experience. Yeah. So obviously, it's like you said, because the format that you currently have right now is not one of which people can easily work with you for long periods of time, although it's gotten better, right? Since you started to do stuff online, people can carry through We talked mm-hmm. about it a few years ago when you were very apprehensive to going online. I was actually pushing you on. I was like, go online, Joseph, go online. I'm glad it was an influence because, this idea, and again, this comes back to adaptability. The idea is that we can't actually learn online is bullshit. I mean, I think it's, we've seen since 2017 in the work that we've done with many students that the learning comprehension, aspects of learning comprehension for me being able to do follow-up and or the base structure of any study with us carries through in a way which is exponentially more ingrained than if we had to be with those people that don't have time in their schedules to come and, work with us all day long and every day. I did that for years, and we had a group of dedicated teachers in Tokyo for about 8 years that were on an apprenticeship with us, and they came to the studio every day. They worked every day. But that was like, they sacrificed so much in their life. Like, so they basically, and it really wore down on people after a while. It's like, it's the old school idea of like apprentice teacher, it's gone, right? So now we're going to a different paradigm. And I think that this is where you've made it very clear many times that you don't want people to become dependent on what you share with them. Those people that did give you testimonials, the athletes that, obviously that were able to just to experience something with you once or three times or five times, they were able to take that informed, experience back into their paid professions. I see it more as a kind of an evolutionary experience. The more maybe they would work with you, whether regardless of the medium, whether they take something that away back home with them after a workshop that they've done with you, and they continue to practice that, even it's a simple thing like the coordinations or any element of the zero forms practice that you do, and take it back and they can diligently practice that every day, or whether somebody's able to go just once, take one piece of information back into their life, that's great. But these athletes have benefited. So, but would you still say that Fighting Monkey is not a practice or not an experience for athletes, or is it? Or like you say, the more intelligent athletes out there, the ones that aren't trying to dope, the ones that aren't, like obviously and there's more of them now from what I can, from what I feel in the world.
I guess what I was trying to say is that I do not like to overpromise or do not overestimate my capacities. That's what I try to communicate to everyone. I just probably try to stay humble. I help anyone who passes through the door with all my heart and all my full dedication. If you pass through the door and you are seeking to solve some challenges you have in your life, you have my all creative power with you. Once I agree to work with you, you have my heart.
That is very humble, and I always got that impression from you. And whenever I see something that you publish that's on a more of a narrative perspective online, or when we've spent time together, or when I've worked with you initially in Athens and then later in Japan when you came, you do have a protocol which you'll work exclusively with people. Is that still something that you do? Do you work one-on-one with people over an extended period of time for specific targeted results?
Yeah, I continue to do that. What we found out, not as powerful, one-on-one is not as interesting as when you have two or three people. They can exchange the information between them and it can become more beautiful. You don't feel so lonely. So I now pair people into smaller groups and we are getting very interesting results. There were clinical results on working people with dementia, Alzheimer's, and they had really good results on their well-being. We had some people that physios gave up on some clients, and then they tried something with FM and it was beneficial. They are here and there. They are some episodical kind of feeling that what we do can be helpful, but we didn't do some long-term studies or we were not collecting scientific data on that. Of course, I collaborate with really, really good scientists now lately with people from haptics, robotics and artificial intelligence. So people that engineer prosthetics and people that are their main interest in science is haptics. Haptics is basically touch. Without touch, we do not know the world, right? This is very, very one of the basic attributes to our capacity to stay and exist and be alive. So we are now exploring how our training would be beneficial for people to rediscover the world if they would be in a trouble, let's say.
I'd like to turn this a little bit to family, because there's one thing I can remember about our first experience with Fighting Monkey in Greece was the reference that you had to learning from your kids. I believe it was within the context of adapting to circumstance. Obviously, when you have kids, there's this unpredictable element that enters your life, which requires your full attention. I mean, I would anticipate it, wouldn't I? I don't have any kids yet, but we're trying. We're going to eventually have one when we can find the practical space to do it. No time like the present, the people say, but we're probably adversely trying to be more practical about it than not. But what you explained from being around your kids was how much you could learn from the unpredictability of their gesture, their moods, their dependence on you. And again, this is something I think that could maybe overlap back into the FM practice, is that it can't just be, you know, I'm anticipating it's not just a hyper-independent experience where everybody that comes in is independent. You're going to give everything to them, obviously, but then they leave and then that's it. I mean, I'm anticipating, just as you would experience with your kids, that there's a certain level of consideration and attention required on your part, which was not part of the plan, that would help you to learn something equally valuable from the experience. I don't want this to be about FM. I'm just more curious. Can you say something about the experience of raising kids? Because raising kids is something that's very interesting. I see so many different people talking about it in different ways. And from how I've heard you talk about it, how you and Linda raise your kids, it's very inspiring. I mean, this is definitely the approach, inspiring me more to, take that same approach to raising my kids, along with some of the stuff that I've experienced. But what about the kids, Joseph? Like your kids, what are your kids teaching you?
Everyone needs to know that I'm a horrible parent, as much as I try, like everything goes wrong. I go with it. I try to train my son in basketball. I'm feeling like I'm a superb coach, but we are fighting all the time. And then I try to say to my daughter, like, don't be so much on the mobile, and that we end up screaming on each other. So just, you understand, it's as human as it gets, right? But there's something beautiful about kids. They make you mortal. You are immortal without kids, but with kids you become mortal. You see how the life grows and how they are depending on you, but also independent, and how they start to form their own view on the world, and how beautifully structured their world, and you're learning how you could be potentially supportive in the development with all your incapacities. That's, I need to remind, especially to myself, that as much as I wish to be the ideal parent, I probably do more mistakes than good stuff. So it's like a trial and error constantly.
Are the mistakes, I mean, do you see them as mistakes, or do you see them as a part of your learning?
No, I don't. Well, no, I don't see them as mistakes. It's a very beautiful dynamic relation. And I'm so happy that they offer so much of insight about life to me. They bounce so much energy back on me, I heard sometimes that the kids can be demanding or they take a lot of time from you. But as I said at the beginning, as I was doing my PhD in communication, and as the fighting monkeys basically about how we can communicate better, that the kids are teaching you how to communicate better, and so they give the most valuable information for your development. And they are wonderful creatures. And I'm not talking about my kids only. I'm talking about kids in general. Of course, now it is not being very much allowed to go and observe kids. But if you want to learn something about comedy, if you want to learn something about life, go to playground and observe kids. This is just such a wonderful material to observe. So, they are everything to me, of course. But kids in general, of course, my kids, they are mine. But I, when I see kids that suffer or they've been abused or abandoned, I feel very touched by that, right? So I wish for all the kids to have an opportunity to explore the world in a safe way, so they can express themselves in the most sound way they can.
The obviously that having a supportive family dynamic is, I think, crucial or central in development, but the less fortunate kids out there that don't have that, you know, obviously this is another example of how adversity could either shape or break somebody's, you know, trajectory in life. And I guess maybe the thing to say with like the less fortunate people out there, they'll still have a chance. And parenting, and when you talk about making mistakes,
absolutely.
But like what you say about making mistakes as a parent, I could be better. I'm sure that you're a fantastic dad, but the mistakes that you think you've made when there's demands on you that the kids have. I mean, I think that these are all just this interaction with your kids. They get to know your character. I mean, I can only anticipate, you know, what some of those things might be. But, you know, even though we haven't spent a lot of time together, I feel like we're brothers from another mother or something like that, or from some other world. We've talked a lot about different things that I think make me understand that the type of challenges that you may have in being a dad. And I think because we share those same qualities in terms of like wanting to experience a lot of different stuff and, with the time, I guess, to be able to allocate towards those different projects. I guess that's another one of the things that was a bit of an aversion right now. You started earlier than me with the kids. From my perspective, is like, at which timing? I mean, I'm 55 years old, and I think I'm going to be pretty healthy. I hope I'll live to be about 85 or 90. And I'm just thinking, well, I do want to be young with my kids too. So the time at which I have my kids. But I mean, I'm also just thinking about parenting now as opposed to parenting 10 years ago would be very different. It's not one situation or the other situation would be better or not, but obviously you work with what you have and the situation as it's dealt with you, and then you make the best out of the situation. Whatever the part of the parenting we don't think we're able to successfully fulfill according to whatever the stereotypical best scenario for parenting, I think offers the children and offers the parent the ability to analyze that even more profoundly than what one might, you know, sort of undervalue, you know. So I think that's a really interesting thing. But when I heard you speak about your kids, and I mean, I think about you, I think about the genetics, Linda and you and those kids. I never met your kids, but I mean, like, I'm thinking about, fuck, like, what the fuck kind of kids are those kids going to be? Because I mean, obviously you guys are both super driven, very unique, creative, dynamic couple, and from genetically different backgrounds merged into this, you know, work life projects where the kids are there kind of being exposed to it. I can't imagine any more positive a situation to be raised in, really. I mean, like, and I know obviously it's not all going to be perfect, but
you know, there's these jokes that we play between each other, between Linda and me. We used to say, like, who's going to die first? So Linda says that she will bury me first, and she knows exactly why, right? So we are making these jokes, and I say, no, I will outlive you. Because Linda's grandmother, she died when she was 108 years old, and not because she was sick, because she choked. So imagine just what is her background. So she has very, very strong roots. And she's also another part of her family. It's from Mani, from Sparta, you know, like, so she's that kind of typical warrior-like heritage. Now, in my family, there's also some kind of joking. You know, my sister called me and she said, Yushko, there was some a long time ago, and she said, Yushko, our parents, they have 70 years anniversary, 70 years there, they will be 70 years old, we have to buy them something. And I said to her in the phone, well, we buy them a coffin. And she said, no, how you can be talking like that? This is not okay. And we closed the phone, blah, blah, blah. And my father called me and he says, I heard that you were talking with your sister. And I said, yes, you said you want to buy us a coffin. And he says, yes, I said that. I said, but we have already coffin. And I said, oh, shit, so okay, you have already coffin. So we buy you the clothes. And he says, no, don't buy. And my mom screams from the back, no, don't buy the clothes because we might get more fat and we will not fit in. And then my father said, don't worry, we'll cut them on the back and we will tape them so it will be still okay. I joke about how long we will live and what is going to be the great quality of life or not. Our kids, they experience our
craziness. They're exposed to our diversity. So they see us in great artistic projects. We work with very famous artists. We work with really amazing musicians. They see us working with costumes designers. They see us working with athletes. They see us traveling for different workshops. They see us studying all the time. So I guess that's also tough for the children, right? Because they see like how I can do what my parents are doing. How is it possible that they do so many things and it seems so much floating and they are never exhausted and they are always smiling or says, so it's also a burden on them. That's not easy for the children. I remember my daughter saying she was in a theater. We had like a, I don't know, maybe 2,000 audience was there and they were clapping after our show and she was crying. And we said, why do you cry? And she said, look what you have and I have nothing.
Wow.
Right. So, you know, like if from their perspective, that's also a challenge. Like I know our daughter, she, I don't know how she looks, but may hopefully she will not be listening to that podcast, but you know how she's looking at the model of her mom, you know, her mom, even if she's in like almost 50, but she's still in a kind of like a fashion magazine being photographed as kind of cultural celebrity or whatever. And she says like, what am I going to do in my life? And that's a very important question that she has. She says, I don't know what I'm going to do. So there is also this type of pressure that they have from us. But I believe what they will take from us is that vitality and interest in life. That's what I believe will happen.
That's inspiring. I mean, I guess that what your daughter said, I mean, but I'm except this is also something obviously that she has something to work with on her own. I mean, to understand whether it's really that important to have what you have or to, you know, to follow her own trajectory in life. And there's no doubt in my mind that you and Linda as parents are going to be offering that the right and supportive environment to sort of guide her along to her own independent choices in her life. I'd like to get close to wrapping this up, but I'd like to, because I there's more that I wanted to talk about, but I think if we go down there, we'll probably end up talking for another hour and a half. Before we move off this, there's a couple of things. What project, apart from Fighting Monkey, are you or Linda currently working on right now? You did mention something about building a center for kids. I mean, what is something that you would like to share with us that maybe wouldn't be so much in the forefront of what you're doing as the FM founders?
Okay, you know that we are a little bit secretive. We do not like to talk about things until they happen. So we have few projects that are going on. So as I told you, I'm currently working on haptic research, which is really, really important and can be beneficial to really a lot of people that are in need. But not only people in need, I mean, anyone can greatly benefit from that kind of contribution. So this is haptic research. Then, as you mentioned, after many years, we decided that we we'll find a space where we can do what we like and not to be in Monad. So we will create kind of headquarters for Rootless Root, for our artistic research, but also for Fighting Monkey, but also create a platform, means a physical center where we can be doing together sculpting, fighting, writing, painting, where we can work with kids or elderly people or professional athletes. It doesn't really matter, but it's a platform on which we can take up the topics that interest us and not worry about any rent. Or people that work with us, they do not have to worry about anything. I would like to take that financial responsibility and give that offering to people that are amazing, right? So we are building up currently a center, and we are doing it all from our own money. We didn't ask any taxpayers' money. We together with help, everyone who ever been in our workshops and in any way supported us, allow this amazing project to happen. And a lot of magic will happen there. I hope we are alive and we are healthy and everything goes well. And so we will have a great center where we can meet and discuss not only my and Linda's ideas, but the ideas of many other great thinkers and philosophers and scientists, and where we can create a good exchange place where people can hear each other and inform each other better. Because eventually health is not absence of illness. The health is capacity to have a network of people and resources that will allow you to overcome the trouble. And this is what I'm interested in, creating a healthy, self-arranging network that is capable of creating creative solutions in a time of trouble.
And so we spend a lot of our, most of our resources there, and it's very risky business, but I'm totally for it and with whatever consequences they had that would happen. But everything seems to be okay, starting from the any single worker that is there until architect and until the constructor. These are all people that know our work. They want to participate. They understand what could be a positive consequences of building of something like that. So this is our next project, and hopefully it goes well.
Where is that space going to be?
It's gonna be in Athens, in kind of central area. It's in a beautiful area, and we decided that building the old factory that we found. We will reconstruct to a level that when you come there, you will feel comfortable. So it's not like I just have an old building and I just put you close to the mushrooms and how we call it, bad air. But it's really, we try to create something where you can feel beautiful and feel happy to explore.
Are you planning on traveling less and having people come to you because of this space?
No, I like to travel. I love to meet people. I just love to do it. So as much as I have energy and as much as people are interested, I will be traveling. This would be more like, let's spend more time together and go more in depth. So my traveling would be more like, get a taste of what we are doing, and if you feel in any way this would be helpful to your life, then that's the place to return and spend more time with us.
That's it. Interesting. I'm looking forward to visiting there. I mean, we eventually, as you know, we're in Canada for a few years now, but for in our trajectory of living will be in Europe in the near future. So I'm hoping that we're going to see more of each other then. But apart from this fantastic new space that you're putting together, are there any performances per se or choreographies in the works?
We are preparing a new show. I'm writing a script with Linda, so we will be in 1 month we will have a premiere in a biggest theater and art festival, which calls Athens and Epidaurus Festival, in the beginning of July, where we prepare a work for 6 performers. So this we are now in the process of creation. That's why I'm a little bit more busy than usual. And but you know, we always every year we create some kind of artwork, so it's always in our radar.
Well, listen, Joseph, I mean, I think that we can wrap up on this today, but there's a I wanted to go down a few different directions of in the narrative with you, but I mean, we can do that, like I say, at a different time in the future. I'm going to be outlining some of the things that we talked about today here in the show notes as a follow-up with people, and where people can, if you don't know who Joseph is, and if you don't know what Fighting Monkey is or Rootless Root, all that will be in the show notes where you can check that out as well. I think this is a good place for us to stop right now. Look, I know you're super busy, and having tried to
Thank you.
coordinate this thing has taken a couple of years. But I'm glad we finally made it happen. I know it's late night for you in Athens. We're looking forward to the next opportunity we actually get to physically see you, Joseph. Very fond memories of our time with you in Athens in 2016, and shortly thereafter in Tokyo. For the couple of weeks that you came and stayed with us, and we collaborated and did some great stuff. It was fun.
Super.
Fantastic work that you're doing. I've seen such an evolution from that time with Fighting Monkey to now. It's inspiring to see how it's developed. Thank you very much for being a part of the Transmission Conversations.
Yeah, I'm so happy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for tuning in today. And again, please consider liking and sharing the episode with others if it resonated with you. You can also subscribe and set up notifications anywhere you listen to or watch this to get real-time updates about all future uploads. And please email us a brief voice memo letting us know what inspired you or pushed your buttons to ideas@baseworks.com. To benefit from exclusive content delivered right into your inbox, consider signing up for our newsletter from the footer on any page of our website. To know more about Baseworks specifically and everything we're doing, visit our website at baseworks.com.
Transmission is copyright 2024 to Baseworks Jasper LLC. You can copy it to share it with others, but for any other uses or derivatives, please send us an email to transmission@baseworks.com.